I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The acclaimed writer Michael Christie joins me now. He's just published his first novel, If I Fall, If I Die. The reviews of this highly anticipated book have been outstanding thus far, and Mr. Christie has emerged as one of the noted writers of our time. His debut collection of fiction, The Beggar's Garden, was longlisted for the Giller Prize and was a finalist for the Writers' Trust Prize and the recipient of the Vancouver Book Award. In this new book, we're taken to Mr. Christie's own hometown of Thunder Bay, Ontario, where we meet Will, who's never been outside with the capital O, is something new, something fascinating for Will, who has spent most of his young life inside with his agoraphobic mother, Diane. I've started the book, and it's quickly drawn me in. The writing is lyrical, conveying the confined space of Will's home, as well as the anxiety of what's outside the door, what's beyond the house, and of course, the why of it all. I'll get Mr. Christie to tell us about this book and more. MichaelChristie.net is the website. The book is published by McClelland & Stewart. He lives on Galliano Island, but joins me from here in Vancouver today. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Michael Christie. Mr. Christie, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Something that I didn't mean to ask, but since you're on the phone, why not?
Mm-hmm.
The coat that you're wearing on the cover of Quill & Quire.
Yes.
It's a snappy-looking piece of outerwear. Where did you get that?
Strangely enough, that photo shoot was styled by a store in Vancouver called Neighbor. They're down in Gastown, and the photographer I was working with decided that she wanted a stylist, so they brought a bunch of clothes along, and I tried to actually keep that coat because it was quite nice, but that wasn't in the cards, so I had to give it back.
Yeah, it's one thing that you notice. Well, I guess when you're living in this part of the world, you want something. I'm assuming that was rainproof.
It was. No, it was a fine garment for sure. And yeah, it was certainly rainproof. Yeah, you don't want to have an unrainproof coat in Vancouver, that's for sure. Yeah,
does it rain as much on Galliano?
No, it's less. I don't know the exact statistics on it, but it's sort of in a rain shadow kind of from the island. So it's actually sunnier than both Victoria and Vancouver.
Ah, yeah. Do you find that you're doing a lot of these things, photo shoots and the sort?
I have been, yeah. It's been a busy few weeks. I've sort of on a little publicity tour. I just got back from Toronto, and yeah, it's been an exciting time. It's great to see, you know, interest in the book, and you know, people are, you know, interested in talking to me about it. So it's been a lot of fun.
And it's been great. I mean, the notices, the reviews. I don't know if you read reviews or not, but the ones I've read, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a glutton for punishment. No, yeah, they've been great. Yeah, there was a great one in the New York Times, which is really surprising, and yeah, it's been exciting so far. With the second book, they, you know, reviewers, I review books myself for the Globe and for the National Post, and you know, with the second book, people take the gloves off a little bit more than they would for, you know, your debut work. So that's to be expected, and it's all fun. It's great.
So the one review that I thought was pretty good was the one from Kirkus.
That's right.
It
said
that the book was reminiscent of Helen DeWitt's The Last Samurai and David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas.
Which I will take. Yeah. Certainly. I think that reviewer got the book on a pretty fundamental level. So I was very happy to see that.
So tell us about Will. How old is he?
He's 11 at the start of the book, and it ends with him around 12.
And so what kind of personality has he got? Because right at the beginning of the book, you get a sense of what interests him.
Yeah. Well, he, as you mentioned, he has spent the majority of his life inside with his mom, who is severely agoraphobic, and who doesn't leave their house ever, you know, and they have food delivered, and they spend their days doing art projects and, you know, getting up to all kinds of things, you know, within the walls of their house. And so resultantly, Will is, you know, somewhat sheltered, and he's somewhat naive, and he also has this sort of kind of unreasonable confidence in himself. He's, you know, they call every painting that he's ever done a masterpiece. And so, you know, when Will does, at the very beginning of the book, opens with Will leaving, you know, the house for the first time, he is surprised by, you know, the outside world, obviously, and by you know, his own sort of inability to process its dangers and menaces and ambiguities.
And I guess the agoraphobic mother, impresses upon him the dangers of being outside, which is why he stays inside for most of his childhood.
That's right. Yeah, and it's there's one point where he sort of mentions that he's doing it for her. Mm-hmm. Like he's growing up, and he sort of has the realization that him, you know, staying safe and doing, you know, wearing a helmet and stuff inside is what keeps his mom from sort of tumbling down into deeper catacombs of fear. And so this is what he does, and it's heroic in a way. He's protecting her, but of course, he's got to grow up too. And so that's sort of the fundamental dilemma of parenting and of growing up is just that, you know, you want your kids to go out into the world, but you know that they're going to be, you know, hurt out there, and they're going to fail tests, and you know there's going to be all kinds of disappointments, and that's the tragedy of it.
He's very clever. He's obviously smart, and he's very curious, mm-hmm. which is why he goes out, I guess. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think, you know, he's grown up with a great, you know, Diane is a very intelligent woman herself, and she's creative, and she was a successful experimental filmmaker prior to sort of really falling into the clutches of the illness. And so she's imparted a lot of that curiosity and sort of excitement for books and for artwork and that kind of thing in him. And so, yeah, I think that's where he gets it from.
Yeah, and so the relationship between the two, that's something that you're obviously fleshing out, working out,
yeah.
writing about throughout the book.
Yeah.
As much as you can tell, like giving away, say, the book, mm-hmm. Looking into the relationship between the mom and the son.
Yeah.
Do you come to any conclusions that are perhaps insightful for people in general who
well, there's
are interested?
One point later on in the book that just, you know, talks about, it's a passage that sort of talks about how fear and love are actually, you know, and this is something I find in my own life or my own experience, that fear and love are actually quite bound together, that, you know, the second that you care about another person more than yourself, I have two young sons, and, you know, like all parents, you know, just have a boundless love for them, but as soon as you do that, you're faced with this problem, and that is, you know, worrying about them. You know, when anything is that valuable to you, it instantly becomes, you know, precious, and it becomes something to protect and to worry over, and to, you know, and it's kind of, it's difficult, and dealing with that duality as a parent, or even, you know, in a relationship, you know, it just seemed to me like such a big part of life that I hadn't seen sort of captured in literature before.
And so being a dad did inform the writing of the book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's very much, you know, a lot of Diane's experiences and, you know, cause we're very much drawn from my own, you know, and I grew, you know, in my 20s and stuff, I was a very kind of daring guy. I did a lot of traveling, you know, I took a lot of risks. And but then I remember there was a moment after I had my first son, and I walked outside and out of the hospital, and I was getting my wife some food, and I remember just looking at the cars that were, you know, that were in downtown Vancouver, and just thinking, like, I can't get hurt, I can't get hit by a car, because there are these people back in this hospital, and they're depending on me, and you know, and I think having a kid just really changes your perception of the dangers of the world. You know, now I see dogs running up to my sons, and you know, I'm worried that they're going to bite them, or you know, I'm constantly sort of assessing the dangers of the world. And I think that's because of, I'm a parent now, and it's because, you know, I'm responsible for these little beings, right? And it's my job to keep them safe.
Have they taken up skateboarding yet?
I'm trying not to push it, because I was a sponsored skateboarder for years. I've done it since, you know, I was about Will's age, in fact. And so, yeah, but I grew up in a family in Thunder Bay that was very kind of hockey-oriented, and so I had hockey rammed down my throat to some degree, and I wasn't that interested in hockey, and so I don't want to do that with skateboarding to my kids. They have skateboards, but I'm very happy to allow them to follow their own interests and do what they do what they want.
So in reading up on you, Michael, you grew up in Thunder Bay, and you had to leave it you had to flee it, didn't you? I mean, not flee it in terms of someone was chasing you, but
right.
You wanted to leave it.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that time it was the middle '90s, and that was a very kind of not hospitable time in Thunder Bay's economic history. So it was like, most young people were not staying. I mean, it was kind of given, that you were going to have to go to seek opportunity, which is a shame because there were times in that city where you didn't. And, there were, great jobs and, the grain elevators were going. And, it was a different time. And so, my reasons were more to just go out and experience the world. I was very enamored by skateboarding, and then also just by the idea of getting out there and experiencing art and traveling and doing all that stuff that young people tend to want to do.
And then I understand in recent years you moved back for a spell.
We did, yeah. My mom passed away in 2008, and my family, and actually it was just before the publication of my first book. And we had a kid, and we were, living in Vancouver. It was extremely expensive, obviously, and so we had the chance to go to Thunder Bay, and I was teaching at the university there, and we bought a house for, essentially nothing, a nice, character house looking at the lake for, what would be the price of a garden shed in Vancouver.
Right.
And it was great, and that was sort of the time when this book really presented itself to me and really commanded my imagination. I spent a lot of time looking at, places that I grew up and walking around the city and sort of thinking about the direction that the city had taken and how different it was to, the Thunder Bay that I remembered. So that was, that's when I wrote the book.
Yeah, and so after writing this book and having it out now as it is, do you make peace, but does it clarify anything about growing up in Thunder Bay for you?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, but the Thunder Bay I portrayed in the book is by no means
what it is,
a perfect representation. Yeah. I think it's very hard to tell the story of a city. I mean, there are many novels about New York, and there are many different sides of New York are portrayed in, in all those different novels, and they're all kind of true, I think, and it's true of a smaller place. But one thing that I was interested in doing was telling the story of kind of like Canada's Rust Belt. There's that fiction in the States where, set in Baltimore and Detroit and, all these places that are kind of these fallen giants, and something about that attracted me, and it felt this opportunity to do that within Canadian literature and to sort of, bring readers' attention to these places, which we don't often see in our literature, and I found that very exciting.
A lot of the reviews describe this book as a coming-of-age story.
Yep.
And I'm sure you're asked how much of your own life is in it, but I'm not going to ask that. What I'm curious to know is what do you think it says about growing up?
I think it's Will's situation. He obviously begins in a very naive and in very sort of almost kind of pure state, and so we follow him as he goes out, and he gets hurt, and he experiences racism, and he experiences all kinds of these sort of darker aspects of childhood and of the adult world, certainly. And so, I mean, I think that all good coming-of-age stories, or the ones that I really like, are very much about that move from innocence into experience. But at the same time, that, things really aren't just bad out there. They're also just incredibly awe-inspiring and wonderful in many ways. And so I guess, I mean, I didn't want to say anything necessarily new about growing up, but I just, I thought that the character of Will was such a great vehicle to sort of demonstrate that movement in a very dramatic way, and to really get at what, you know, it means to be a kid.
Yeah. Did you, in the course of writing this, want to say something to the reader about agoraphobia and what that is?
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot. I did a ton of research. I read, you know, 40 first-person memoirs, you know, about, you know, written by people who are suffering from the disease. I read all kinds of psychiatric literature. I also read, you know, anything that I could find that was, you know, literary fiction based on the disease. And what I found is it's, weirdly enough, it used to be thought of as fear of the open spaces, like the agora is like the marketplace in Greek, and it's, you know, people thought it was that agoraphobes were afraid of open air, but it's actually not true. It's actually that they're afraid of having a panic attack in a place where they don't feel safe. And so it's actually kind of fear of fear, which I find just completely interesting. And it, you know, it's a, you know, it's the fear of fear itself, as, you know, Roosevelt told us not to. And so I don't know. I think it's on the rise, certainly in our society, and it's kind of this spiral of thinking that we could get into, and I don't know. It's just, to me, it's such a dramatic and timely thing to explore.
And I mean, you've had some experience with it. You dedicate the book to your mother, who had it.
She did.
Do you understand where it comes from, perhaps?
I mean, I don't know, and that's the thing. I mean, I my mom, yeah, absolutely, she was agoraphobic, not in the manner or the severity necessarily as Diane is in the book, but, you know, very similarly. And I've done so much. I mean, I grew up thinking about why my mom was, you know, she couldn't go on trips, and there would be just some days she couldn't leave the house. And, you know, when you're a kid, these things are just completely puzzling. And, you know, I have an undergraduate degree in psychology. I worked in mental health institutions, and I haven't got a good explanation yet. I don't think there really is one. The brain chemistry explanation doesn't wash. You know, all kinds of reasons that I've heard just don't seem to ring true for me. And I guess I look at it and I often just think it's that my mom, or that anyone with agoraphobic or panic anxiety, just doesn't have the ability to tell themselves that they're going to be okay and believe themselves. And when you lose that ability, things get very, very, very difficult. And that's, you know, all I can really say with any surety.
And I guess what the book does is it helps us as the general public, I guess, understand it better and perhaps react to it better.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of great fiction's great strengths. I mean, we can watch anything on Netflix these days. We can find any, you know, any thing we want to see pretty much instantly. But what fiction does, I think, is provides us with the texture of someone's mind. And when it's someone whose mind is turning in on itself and is eating itself alive in a way, it's a very intense experience, but I think it's a very illuminating one for, you know, I don't know what it's like to have agoraphobia. I mean, I did my very best to represent it with words, but I mean, I feel like the reader will come away with an understanding of, you know, what it means to be in the grips of something like this, and how, you know, how debilitating it can be, and also how it can be perhaps, you know, mitigated and perhaps, you know, reduced.
Did you always want to write?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did a bunch of, I've had a million different jobs, and I've done all kinds of things other than write. But I grew up in a very sort of literary household, and I always, I think, had this plan in the back of my mind that I would someday try to write literary fiction. But I, you know, it took me a long time to actually sort of take the risk and do it.
So you do it now as a full-time job, I gather.
It is, yeah. I'm in a very lucky position to be doing it full-time. Yeah, I've got a little writing studio on Galliano Island, and I go in there, and I don't have Wi-Fi access, and I, you know, stare at the laptop for 5 hours a day, which is an incredible luxury. And I have many friends who are writers and who are trying to write novels, you know, when they're working full-time or when they're parents, and it's difficult. So I try to remind myself just how lucky I am to have the ability to actually dedicate myself to it.
And are you one of these writers that needs to have those 5 hours a day? I mean, are you writing on book tour now?
No. It's a question of, I would love to have 5 hours a day now to do it. But yeah, when I'm out of my element and I'm taking cabs around and I'm doing all these new things and speaking to people in new cities, I find it very hard to kind of keep my mind contained enough to really sort of delve into something. But yeah, I mean, when I'm home, I'm a pretty, pretty regimented guy. I spent a lot of my life in a very sort of disorganized fashion, and these days I'm really appreciating, like, having a regular schedule and sticking to it.
So is this a career that you have now, being a writer?
Yeah.
Is this what you thought you'd be doing, say, as a kid?
No. I mean, certainly no. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, I still pinch myself that, that I'm able to actually make it work. And, I could have done a million things. I mean, I was a mental health worker for years, and I enjoyed the work. And I could have stayed there. I mean, just as easily, I think. I think the sort of romantic notion that people are born writers, or that you're born with some sort of special spark that just is undeniable, is very false and very untrue. I mean, I've had the opportunity to meet some of my favorite writers and people, who I think are geniuses, and you talk to them, and they just have a very pragmatic way of thinking of their work, and they work very hard, and they're interested. They have a limitless interest in the subject. So it's not, they were born with some innate gift as much as I think it just fits for them, and they've arranged their life in a way that they are able to do it.
So what point for you when you're writing something, like you're writing parts of If I Fall, If I Die, do you realize that this is, I don't know if you'd say this is really great, but you'd say to yourself perhaps that it's good enough to put out there? I mean, do you know that? Does someone tell you that?
Yeah, I mean, I have readers. I have an agent, and I have my wife who reads, everything I write. And it's difficult, though. I mean, the hardest thing is, I'm a very, I love language on the sentence level, and I put a lot of care into the way that I construct prose and words, and so I can be easily seduced by a great sentence that doesn't necessarily fit into the narrative, or it feels off in terms of the pacing of the story, and so that's the danger for me. And I'll often, but I've got relationships now with editors and really smart people who I trust, and like, if they tell me that this sentence that I that I love is not doing its job within the whole of the piece, then I'm I'll cut it, which it was very difficult for me when I was beginning, but it's getting easier as you go. So,
and I'm sure on this book tour you're being asked if you're working on another novel now, are you?
Yes, and I am. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I'm still, I mean, I like to reserve my right of refusal as I'm working, because I actually began a few projects before If I Fall, If I Die, and abandoned them because they just didn't have the electricity that really needs to sustain a long project, I think. And so, but this new one is feeling pretty good.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, and as I said, I'm enjoying the book, and I'm really looking forward to finishing it. Good luck with it, and congratulations.
Thanks very much, Joe. I appreciate it.
The website for more, michaelchristie.net. The book is called If I Fall, If I Die. Do get it. It's such an engaging book, and as I said, I've started it, and it's hard to put down. It's from McClelland and Stewart. It's author Michael Christie. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.